Without any sleight of hand, it's possible to show that current never existed in the first place. And because current is a mathematical fiction, Watts, as a consequence of voltage times current, is also a fiction. Thus, power is a fiction, and the colloquialism that we call energy, which is really power, is a fiction. So it all goes back to voltage. Voltage is not a fiction. That's the only thing that is not a fiction, along with resistance and inductance and capacitance and phase relation and frequency. Those are not fictions, but everything else is. So let's go back to simple voltage drop in a non-reactive circuit made up of simply resistors. We know that voltage in equals voltage out because you go around the circuit and all the voltages have to add up when you do your voltage drop analysis. But that's merely for voltage, and it's merely for a non-reactant circuit. That is the case. But everything else we come to assume, energy in equals energy out, is a bunch of hooey just on that basis alone, even before we get into a reactive circuit. Just a simple voltage drop circuit, a simple resistive circuit. It's a bunch of hooey to assume that energy in has to equal energy out, because energy is a fiction, wattage is a fiction, power is a fiction, current is a fiction, voltages and resistance is not a fiction in a non-reactive circuit. So why is that the case? Well, current is a local phenomenon. I better back up. We have another problem, or I have another problem, with what we don't recognize as a problem. We have this wrong notion of what energy is. So let's look at the domain of the atom, and let's look at it from the physicist's point of view. You know, we've got the nucleus of the atom composed of protons and neutrons giving most of the weight, most of the mass of that atom. Very little is out in the electron shell. Now, most of the electron shells are all occupied. So we have to ignore them, ignore the nucleus, and the only area of the atom that pertains to electrical engineering are the valence electron shell, the one that is not fully saturated with electrons. That's the one that's going to exhibit behavior that the electrical engineer is going to look for. Electrical engineering behavior. Electrical behavior. It's the only place you're going to find it in the atom. When the copper atoms, let's say, in a coil of wire are behaving in an electrical manner, it's only those valence electrons that are going to be doing the behaving, performing that behavior. None of the rest of the electrons, nothing inside the nucleus, it's all off the chart. It's not even part of any consideration. And so E equals MC squared has nothing to do with electrical engineering. Nothing absolutely whatsoever. Electrons don't have any mass to begin with, and we're not even utilizing all of the electrons anyway. So I've got a problem with how we say, oh, energy in has to equal energy out. So I've already covered it with voltage drop, in a sense, but not completely. I've just given you an overview. And now, just from the point of view of the components of an atom, it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. Now, let's try... Now, there's one more feature. So, when... This idea that energy travels down a wire, or along a wire inside a coil, for that matter, is also another bogus idea. It's a lie. It's a fiction. What travels down the wire is information, because the wire is alive with consciousness. And this is something we don't ascribe to reality. We think, well, consciousness, we ascribe it to maybe animals, you know, and certainly not to plants, unless we're on the fringe. It's definitely not to rocks. So how can we say there's consciousness in the wire? Well, I'll show you how, by a very simple illustration. Copper atoms are no different than robots. in which they have to do what they're told to do in a kind of collective fashion, a kind of collective mentality, shall we say, a collective consciousness of all the copper atoms inside the copper coil. They subscribe to a kind of collectivity in managing how they behave as a wire, because you're not going to see electrical engineering behavior in any single copper atom. You will see changes, but it won't be the kind that the electrical engineer is accustomed to. It'll be very simple changes, rising and falling, and that's it. But when we get a mass of copper atoms configured as a coil, or even a straight piece of wire for that matter, and we've got so-called energy traveling down the wire, now we got phase relation, we got frequency to deal with, because the copper atoms are not going to behave at the same time the same way. They're going to behave differently depending on where they are located in that wire. And this is important because there's no energy traveling between one copper atom and the next. But there is information, because the copper atoms are aware of each other through voltage. Voltage is the means by which they communicate with each other, not current. So the silly notion of electromagnetic radiation traveling through the emptiness of space is a bunch of hooey, because it can't even travel across the emptiness of space between two copper atoms, let alone through the vastness of outer space. Just the inner space of matter, it can't even travel. The only thing that travels is voltage, and it's immediate. There's no transit time. The response within each copper atom does take time. There is a time delay, and we call that the speed of light, but it's a time delay because the valence electrons take time to respond to a change in voltage. So now I'm segueing, I'm preparing you for how I say that current is a fiction, and consequently Watson energy is a fiction. There's a time delay when that valence electron responds to a change in voltage in its immediate surroundings, affecting itself, because voltage doesn't need a wire to carry it. In fact, the emptiness of space between two copper atoms, or for that matter between two planetary bodies or two stellar bodies, is not unlike the dielectric material, I should say, inside a capacitor, in which we block the flow of current, but only voltage behavior manifests on both sides of that dielectric barrier. It's the same thing in the empty space between two copper atoms. No current travels. There's a capacitance there, and a voltage response on either side of that empty space between two copper atoms. Or I should say the behavior ends up in the two points of location, the two proximities of the two copper atoms, namely their valence electrons. But the behavior gets across the space because it's a voltage. They feel each other's voltage. They feel each other's voltage, and as the voltage changes, they respond. The voltage changes in their environment, in the copper atoms surrounding any one particular copper atom. That one in the center feels the changes, and he responds in the correct manner. Because dominoes, you just think of dominoes, you know, you set up dominoes, and depending on how you set it up and how you flick your initial domino to get it to cascade will determine the outcome. And there are variations, obviously, imperfections in how you set it up. The wind might be blowing in the room. Moisture may be accumulating. But aside from all those imperfections, there's a kind of determination. And domino players who like to set up dominoes for the purpose of, you know, creating the domino effect, so to speak, is a certain certainty of what the outcome will be. But sometimes it doesn't, because there's of the slight imperfections in their setup. But lo and behold, most of the time they get the response they expect, and it's awesome. Well, that's the same way copper atoms work, and that's the same way computers work. When we program to behave a certain way and they're not allowed to think or learn, they simply follow the software instructions they were given to do the commands they were told to perform. They just do it because they don't ask questions, they don't argue, they don't talk back, they don't walk off in a huff. They just do it. And the copper atoms are no exception. And so the arrangement of components in an electrical circuit is much like programming software, in which the software has to be told what to do, because it can't do it itself. It's not allowed to do it itself. And this, it's the same way in a circuit, an analog circuit. You tell it what to do based on your arrangement and how you manage it. And like clockwork, it has to perform the end result. Now, there'll always be imperfections, so that each time you run it, it'll be slightly different. But for the most part, generally, it comes out to be about the same. Because it has to. It's like dominoes, setting up dominoes. It has to behave a certain way. So the copper atom doesn't have a choice. It doesn't have free will. It has a little bit, though. But we don't see that. Collectively, in mass, all we see is the group behavior, and it tends to average out, especially from our distant perspective, from our macroscopic perspective. And so we see a certain consistency or a reliability as to what the outcome was going to be. A certain reliability. Well, yet that does not take away from the fact that in order for that behavior to happen, the copper atom has to be conscious. It has to be alive with consciousness. And this is why the physicist gets away with claiming that photons traverse the emptiness of space and manage to carry energy down the length of the wire. That's so bogus, it's pathetic. Because it ignores the fact that you can have consciousness in all matter, in all of creation. It's just not the consciousness you and I are accustomed to, namely human beings talking and walking and doing whatever. It's very different for a different life form. It's a different type of consciousness. Well, we're familiar with the consciousness of a computer, so why don't we use that as our analogy for a copper atom? Or dominoes. When you set up dominoes, you don't even need computers. Dominoes have been around for ages. So you see, we don't think of the right analogy to make in order to define what it is we're discussing. And we think, oh no, there's no consciousness there. Oh, it's there. It's no different than the consciousness of a domino. When you've set it up, it'll create a cascade effect and manage to produce a beautiful work of art in motion. And that's what the copper atoms do in the copper wire. We set it up, we create the circuit, and it seamlessly, flawlessly, repetitiously, reliably, consistently gives us very similar results over each time that we turn on that circuit, or else we wouldn't get light in our room when we turn on the light switch, would we? We'd get something else. But most of the time, we keep getting the same thing, because that's the way that level of consciousness operates. It can't operate any other way, but with a very distinct reliability. But that doesn't mean it's dead. Even a circuit that we turn off, that we say, oh, it's not alive anymore, it's not dead. Because the energy is in the copper atom. It doesn't travel down the wire. Only information travels down the wire, not energy. So the circuit is never off. And the only point of having a voltage source, such as a battery, is to give a command. So that you can, it's that first flick that you give to the domino at one end, and now the whole cascade effect occurs. That's what the voltage source is for. And that's the way it should be used, but we don't. But that's a whole nother, I don't want to get sidetracked. Well, I should though. We operate our circuits on two simple-minded style of thinking. We say, okay, the load requires a certain amount of voltage to operate. And so we say, okay, so we better supply that much voltage, or else we're not going to get the load to perform as we expect it to. Wrong answer. It's good to know how much the load requires, but it's wrong to assume that we have to give it that much in order for it to behave that way. Not directly, but indirectly. You know, when you want to give somebody lumber to build a house, What do? You give them lumber? Do you give them money to buy the lumber? Do you give them a job to earn the money to buy the lumber? Or do you give them the seeds to plant the forest that he will then reap the reward of all that lumber from that small quantity of mass of seeds that he planted? This is the way free energy operates. You don't give somebody the lumber. You certainly don't give them the money to pay for the lumber. You give them seeds and let them grow their own forest to their liking and harvest the benefit of that forest. That's free energy. That's how free energy operates. So, but we don't do that. We're not trying. In fact, part of the problem is, okay, well, let's go back to the analogy again. Don't give somebody free food, give them a job. Well, don't give them lumber, give them seeds so they can appreciate where all that wood came from and all the labor and time it took to grow that forest. And then they'll be willing to manage it and not just, you know, harvest the forest and never replant those trees. And we have end up with the Sahara because of overgrazing. So if we approach that approach, take that approach in designing a free energy circuit, now we've got the intelligence to not suppress. See, this is the problem. If you give somebody the lumber to build a house rather than giving him the seeds to grow the forest so that he can reap his own lumber to build his house, now he gets lazy. But in the case of a circuit, it's not a question of laziness. It's a question of being smothered. You know, if you've got a big, huge boulder on your chest and you're laying flat on the floor, you can't inhale, can you? But you can exhale. In fact, you'll probably pop. You'll exhale so fast. But you won't be able to inhale. So how long will you last? It depends how long you make your exhale last. If you don't get to make it last very long, you're not going to last very long, are you? And even then, it doesn't matter because you're using up oxygen. So it almost, but not quite, doesn't matter how long it takes for you to exhale. It does matter, but really, in a sense, it doesn't, because you won't be able to inhale at all. So come time, when your blood becomes deficient, after the fact of you having exhaled, now you can't inhale, and whoopsie-doodle, you're going to die, right? Well, that's what the circuit does. That's what our circuits do. The electric car dies because you haven't taken the time to recharge your batteries, because you're not allowed to operate the circuit properly so that you don't kill the incentive to reap free energy. So instead of giving it the voltage it requires, it's good to know what it is, the load, the motor load, how much energy it requires, but it's best not to give it that. It's best to set up an intermediate circuit between the load and the source that will take those that seed of energy, that tiny little spark of energy that you give that intermediate circuit, and then you grow it. And hopefully you grow it quickly enough so that your load does not become deficient at any point in time more than, see, or on average. It does not become deficient on average such that it doesn't have enough energy to operate. Now, that's not to say that at one point in time you have too much and another point in time you have too little. That's when you have to bring in the principle of the flywheel. Whether it's a mechanical flywheel or a magnetic flywheel, you know, magnetic flywheels do exist, and Tesla made use of it. It's called iron. Non-magnetized, but magnetizable iron. In other words, you don't have a permanent magnet, you don't have an electromagnet, you simply have ferromagnetizable material, such as iron or whatever. And you have lots of it. Lots and lots of massive amounts of ferromagnetic material. And now you've got yourself a flywheel that can store the momentum of magnetism. And the more mass of iron you have, the more momentum you can store. It's pretty cool. And it acts as a flywheel so that when you have variations in your intermediate circuit, pulsing or whatever, varying its output, because it's not going to be seamless, it's not alternating current, which is highly regulated, it's going to be slightly underregulated so that it can overreact. And it's going to do so in a in a periodic fashion. And the periodic fashion, though, is not, I shouldn't say periodic, in an oscillatory fashion that won't necessarily be periodic. So you're going to get variations at any moment in time, but overall it'll average out, and then your load will be happy, especially if those ups and downs are fast enough. The motor load won't notice the difference. That's the whole principle behind pulse width modulation techniques, is to give square waves of certain width or duration, I should say, certain duration and certain amplitude, along with gaps in between. And when those three elements are composed correctly, the motor load won't know the difference between that and a nice clean sine wave, and the motor load will operate. So we have to understand that that's probably going to have to be incorporated as another intermediate step after the power multiplication intermediate step and before the motor load. So now we got four steps. We got a tiny little spark of a voltage input followed by the magnification, which is not going to be periodically reliable, but on average it will be. And then we've got the modulation of that into the semblance of a sine wave, so that the motor load at the fourth stage of this process can handle what it's receiving and be able to operate as a motor and not cause weird things to happen. Now, the second step of the magnification of that initial tiny spark happens because we bring in something that we haven't bothered to bring into the circuit, and that's electrical reactance. We never bother to because, we never think of it as a power amplification technique. We think of it as a post-power supply technique to modify a power supply, but not to create it. And that's our own fault for not giving credit where credit is potentially possible to be due, an opportunity of technology that we don't make use of. So it's funny when I phrase it that way, because it's very similar to MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, is only allowed to be used, the AMA, which is a union of doctors, has nothing to do with what's good for us, it's what's good for them. A union of doctors who has decided that MRIs can only be used for diagnosis, it cannot be used for therapy. Well, let me tell you, if you've ever been in one, it'll normalize you if the abnormality has anything to do with your electrical system, your nervous system. It'll normalize it. So let's say if you're having some kind of problem and it's psychosomatic, in which most of the causation is coming from your mind or your nervous system or both, that MRI will fix it. And it'll only fix it for 24 hours, but it will fix it completely for 24 hours. And then it'll lapse back into your abnormality condition, because your body has all the things going on, creating a certain momentum of its own, a chemical momentum and whatnot, habit patterns of subconscious habit patterns or whatnot that want to kick back in. But the MRI will take care of it for 24 hours. Well, it's never used for therapy, though. It's not allowed to be used. It can only be used for diagnosis. Well, it's the same problem here. We use electrical reactance to finish up a power supply situation, to kind of trivially polish it up. But we never really use it in a serious manner. And this is what I've been studying for the last 4 years, is it's coming on to close to five now, how to use it seriously. And it's a certain skill you can't get from a book, and you won't get it from school because they don't teach it in school. And who do you apprentice yourself to? Well, maybe somebody like Eric Dollard, but most people who are, classically trained, formally trained in electrical engineering or physics, don't think highly of Eric Dollard. They because out of ignorance, they don't know better. So electrical reactance changes the situation, because now you can magnify power or diminish it at will, because it's not energy that you're diminishing or increasing. It's information that you're manipulating. telling the behavior of the copper atoms to behave in a fashion different than what we've been telling them to behave all along. And we're so accustomed to thinking in terms of AC power, which is a highly regulated type of functionality to an energy system, that we don't think of anything that's underregulated, such as electrical reactance is highly underregulated. And we use electrical reactance to compensate for other behaviors of electrical reactance that are underregulated. But here we have an opportunity to play God, basically, with energy by recognizing that it's the energy of the atom that we're manipulating, and it stays inside that atom. We cannot get more energy out of a coil than what's already in there. It's in the valence electrons. If we tried to get more energy out of that copper coil than what's located in those valence electrons, we'd blow up the coil into microscopic particles of copper dust, so microfine, nanofine, that it would suspend itself in air. It wouldn't even fall to the ground. It would just blow around until it finally dissipates. Until it oxidizes, it's not going to have the weight necessary to fall to the ground. It probably has to, an action of precipitation has to bring it down to the ground anyway. That's why we have smog in LA, because there's no rain, no fog that can precipitate and drop the particles of smoke and whatnot out of the air and cleanse the air. So, because it's microfine. Well, it's the same way when you blow up a copper coil. When you've used energy too extreme, more than the valence electrons are equipped to handle, because the valence electrons are busy holding the copper together as a coil. And here we're using it for a different purpose, a purpose to which it was not intended. It was intended to hold the copper together as a piece of metal, as a metal wire. And yet here we are sending energy through it, causing it to become unstable. So we're paying a price for the energy we send through that copper coil by destabilizing its integrity as a coil. And once we exceed that integrity by telling it to become too energized, now the whole thing just evaporates into a cloud of dust. So the energy stays in that copper atom, but it can behave in a way that will amount to its own self-destruction. Yet it still comes from inside the valence electrons of that copper atom. It doesn't come from any other part of the atom. And only because we sent information down the wire in the form of the engineering of electrical reactance, that tells the atom to overbehave or underbehave, blow up, not blow up. Hey, you can't get a wire to blow up unless there's more energy there than what you put in, because your source would have blown up before you even sent it into the coil. So how can you possibly get away with saying that a coil blew up because you sent energy into it that you couldn't even handle at the source? I mean, your source couldn't handle it. Copper coils are pretty stable. I mean, it's not like we're trying to blow up a battery, which is very unstable to begin with because it's highly reactive chemically. We've allowed that to be the case. We've engineered it to be the case. But the copper coil, a battery that supplies the energy, the raw voltage to that coil in an attempt to blow it up, that battery's going to blow up long before the coil does. So it just doesn't make logical sense that energy in has to equal energy out in so many different ways. The logic doesn't work. Now, let's go back to what I started with and finish that off. Current is a fiction. Thus, wattage and energy and power is a fiction. So as far as electrical engineering is concerned. So let's take a look at current. Where does it come from? It's a mathematical fiction, a type of shorthand notation. We use letter capital I to represent current, and yet it replaces something slightly more complicated, which has nothing to do with current, voltage divided by resistance. We put that back into the Ohm's law where it belongs by removing the symbol that represented it all this time, the symbol for current, And now we have voltage squared over resistance equals power. There's no current anywhere. And yet we have power. We have power without current. We have power without current. Can you imagine that? Can that be possible? Power without current? Strictly voltage? Well, we have two types of voltage there. It's voltage squared. Ah, now this gets tricky. How can you have two types of voltage? This is how. Because we have time distinguishing between the two types of voltage. One type of voltage does not change over time because it's applied voltage. It's the voltage difference between the two terminals of that coil. And it goes along the length of the coil. The other voltage is dependent on that voltage, the length of the coil difference between the two terminals of the coil, but brings in a second aspect, and that's the voltage that changes over time along the length due to resistance of the coil, both the inductive resistance and the plane resistance, causes the voltage to change, yet we still have voltage which is being applied from the outside versus the reactive voltage that comes out of that situation. Now, if you have a simple circuit involving simply resistance, all you get is voltage drop. But with a coil, it gets slightly more complicated, but it's still reactive voltage. The voltage that reacts to the resistance of the coil or the wire or whatever it is, it's reacting to the resistance. And over time, creates further changes of voltage, but only as a reaction, the output. In other words, the reactive voltage is the output. So we have two voltages. One is the input, and the other is the output. And those are the two inputs and outputs we pay attention to, the voltage going in and the voltage coming out. And as far as the simulator goes, that's all it pays attention to. Current is a convenience. That's all it is. It doesn't fundamentally exist, but we want it to exist. We want it so badly that we create a pattern, and we recognize the pattern and we call it current, but it's actually voltage divided by resistance that we're recognizing and substituting the term current for voltage divided by resistance, implied over time, as a reaction, as an outcome, as an output. So current is the output. Voltage is the input. That's how that works. And so to say that energy in has to equal energy out is not even an appropriate statement. It doesn't even exist. It's the voltage in and the current that comes out. Understanding that current is a fiction anyway, because if current is the voltage divided by resistance, causes the outcome of voltage that's different from the voltage that went in. Unbelievable. We can't even think about these things in a way that makes any logical sense. So, that's simple Ohm's law. But when we get into electrical reactant formulas, strange things happen, which can only be explained in the terms of information, because now, when we're dealing with electrical reactants, we're dealing with frequency, you know, angular momentum, you know, frequency, pi, 2 pi, what is it? 2 pi times frequency, angular momentum. And then we have capacitance, or we have inductance, and then the outcome is capacitive reactance. Instead of saying voltage going in and then versus voltage coming out, now we have capacitance going in and capacitance coming out, or inductance going in and inductance coming out. In other words, we design the coil to have a certain amount of inductance, but that doesn't mean that's what comes out of it. It could be something totally different comes out of it. And that change of inductance or change of capacitance is called parametric excitation. You know, in the case of a resistor, we have what's called voltage drop, namely voltage in versus voltage coming out. But when we have a reactive component, such as a coil or a capacitor, now we've got a funny anomaly when we combine the two in pairs. You know, it's not enough to make a simple LRC circuit. and just have one inductor, one coil. Oh, but it all adds up to be the same, so let's just do that. No, no, no. If you set up two inductors and two capacitors, now you've got a beat frequency of capacitive reactance and a beat frequency of inductive reactance. And when you blend those two types of beat frequencies together, now you get the disappearance of energy or the amplification of energy. And then we scratch our heads and wonder why. Because if you combine two cosines together and the waveform that cosine generates, you get a beat frequency, and the beat frequency is not going to equal the input of the two cosines. The outcome is going to be something different. It's going to be less. It's going to be more. It can be anything you want it to be. So even the math doesn't support this idea of energy in, it has to equal energy out. Just two cosines. It's called Mathlet or Mathlets, plural, .org. MathLets, I want to say, .org. And you look up poles and vibrations, and you play with the sliders on that thing. It's a JavaScript program. Or is it JavaScript or Java? I think it's JavaScript, yeah. I think it's JavaScript. In any case, you create a graph of a sine wave designed by two cosines. So I shouldn't say sine wave. It's a cosine wave. But the addition of those two cosines creates some pretty interesting phenomenon. In a nutshell, you'll see that a wave can increase in amplitude just by creating a beat frequency. Now, I believe the term for that is called pure resonance from the standpoint of mathematics. But from the standpoint of electrical engineering, it's called resonant rise, which is well known to destroy equipment and is not allowed to happen for that reason. But suppressing resonant rise or allowing it to happen under regulation, partial regulation, rather than full regulation that would suppress it, is the whole goal of a free energy enthusiast, is to not try to micromanage everything. And I'm telling you, it's very easy to want to, but you don't get to. You have to artfully undermanage it, the situation, so that you get more energy out than what you put in. And it takes a certain amount of faith that it's possible to develop the skill, because no one's going to teach it to you. You're not going to read it from a book. You've got to play around with a simulator and figure out how to do it, and then you got to play around with building it. Now, I haven't gotten to the stage of playing around building it, but I've managed to develop a certain skillfulness of simplification, because it's very important, because when it comes time to build it, you better have the thing really simple so as to increase the chances that you'll succeed. Otherwise, if you have a circuit that's too complicated, any number of things could go wrong. You won't know which are the cause of what went wrong. Was it something to do with, oh, it's not possible? Or is it something to do with, oh, you didn't design the circuit properly? You'll never know the difference. But if you simplify the circuit, the free energy circuit, down to the most simplified approach, and let me give you a hint. Nathan Stubblefield had it, but he didn't put it in his patent. The way he drew up the patent for his Earth battery is not entirely the way it operates. And I had to take 4+ years of training on simulators to get me to the point that I could approach the mystery of the Amon brothers of 1921 and discover that what they did has to be Nathan Stubblefield. All the clues point to that. All the simulation work I've done points to that. They replicated Nathan Stubblefield, but they took it one step further and applied it to a motor vehicle and to a power supply for their home use. While Nathan Stubblefield took a different approach, a more natural approach, something a naturalist like Charles Darwin would appreciate, or any other naturalist. But the Amon brothers took it and brought it into the city and said, no, we're going to not be a country bumpkin farmer, a melon farmer from Kentucky that Nathan Stubblefield was in his day job. We're going to put it inside of automobiles and put it on in our homes in the cities. And this is something Nathan Stubblefield couldn't deal with, because his use of that technique or that technology was strictly for the non-electrosmog polluted environment situation, because he was using the earth as his ultimate source of energy, and his technology was just there to make use of it. But the Amon brothers went a step further and started to micromanage it so that it does create electrosmog pollution, just like we do. They did as well. But they managed to still base their technology on Nathan Stubblefield, which also is standing on the shoulders of Oliver Heaviside and his transatlantic telegraph cable problem. So it's these are the people you study to figure out the simplest way of creating free energy, even simpler than what Tesla got into. He got into some pretty complex, high-voltage, high-frequency stuff. And you don't have to. I mean, it's amazing what Nathan Stubblefield achieved. It's truly remarkable. If you look up all the stories on the guy, it's unbelievable. And the Amon brothers did a pretty good job, too, standing on the shoulders of Nathan Stubblefield, who was standing on the shoulders of Oliver Heaviside. It's amazing what those people managed to accomplish, because they looked at the situation from a totally different way. When I go into a simulator, the simulator doesn't tell me about the mass of iron being used. That's the part that's missing. Now, when I study all it tells you is you've got to connect components together. That's an electrical connection. That's not a magnetic connection. Oh, and they do allow for a magnetic coupling of coils, but that's about it. You don't get to specify the mass of iron inside the coil. There are ways of increasing it beyond the dimensions of the interior of space of that coil by magnetically coupling a larger mass of iron outside the coil to outside the core of the coil, magnetically coupled to the core of that coil. And it starts to do interesting things, because when I started looking at the software code, the open source software code of Paul Falstead Simulator, I was flabbergasted to learn that, first of all, the electrical reactance formulas are right inside the software for determining the output of coils and capacitors. So you apply voltage, but what you get out of it is something more complicated than just voltage drop alone. And yet it's electrical reactance formulas that dictates what comes out, but within a certain context. And that's another fascinating aha moment, is that the context is a current source. And let's take the example of an inductor, best of all. The inductor, the software code for the simulation of a coil, is predicated, in a larger sense, on a current source, not a voltage source. Now, we know what a voltage source is, a battery, in which the voltage is regulated, but the current is allowed to vary. That's why a battery can blow up if you don't give a proper amount of resistance between when you connect the two terminals together. Too much current will flow too quickly in a shorter time frame and blow up the battery, or at least it'll overheat it, at the very least. Well, when we look at a current source, it's the opposite. We regulate the current, and the voltage is allowed to vary. And this is exactly the framework, the context within which is placed the electrical reactant formula for inductivity, for inductive reactance, is placed within a greater context of a current source, and that is placed within the context of the outcome of an inductor, or a capacitor for that matter, except we substitute in place of inductive reactance, we put in capacitive reactance, but we still have a current source surrounding that that electrical reactance. We still have a current source that we're defining in order to define the output of that capacitor or coil. And that's a very interesting concept, because it means there's something else going on that's not merely electrical reactance, let alone voltage drop. And that's what Tesla and Nathan Stubblefield and the Amon brothers and Oliver Heaviside were getting at when they got into iron and how you make use of ferromagnetic material. You change the situation, because you're creating a current source when you, the minute you start to involve yourself with the use of iron. Now, we minimize the use of iron, thinking it's not important. But that's because we don't want it to be important. But it is very important. Because a current source changes the picture of the thing drastically. One of my biggest problems in creating free energy circuits is regulating their outcome. Most of the time, all I do is create an explosion. And on the simulator, it's safe. I don't get electrocuted. But how do you regulate the darn thing to prevent it from exploding in your face? Oh, I get more energy out than in, and sometimes instantaneously an infinite amount within an infinitely small amount of time. But regardless of whether or not that's a reality check or something, it makes no difference. The fact of the matter is, it's possible to make a circuit explode in such a way that it destroys itself. Even though you didn't give it energy that would have been destructive, yet the circuit destroyed itself nonetheless with more power than you gave it. And that's why spontaneous combustion occurs, because the same thing happens inside of a person or a mammal or whatever undergoing spontaneous combustion, is that something electrical went out of hand before it transferred that out-of-hand condition or conditional behavior to the chemistry of that substance, causing it to oxidize too quickly and blow up into a mass of flame. It was electrical first before it became oxidative. Well, I'm learning now that a current source is how you regulate it. And you have to insert, you know, let me give you a hint. Mag amps, magnetic amplification, I can't remember what mag amp stands for. I think it's magnetic amplification. It was invented, I believe, in the 1840s or 1850s and used for theater lighting. But it's an interesting prospect of interpreting the situation of what Nathan Stubblefield and the Amon brothers were doing. When you bring iron into the situation, you bring in the possibility for control of what would otherwise be an unregulated event that would blow up in your face. And that completes the mystery for me in training myself. How do I create an overunity circuit? Oh, I got past the problem of overunity a long time ago, almost in just a few weeks, and I figured I started creating success story after success story, except they all exploded in my face. And regulation was not easy. Paul Babcock tried to use switches, you know, transistors, to quickly switch, and all his transistors were blowing up because they couldn't handle the voltage. Well, you have to bring in a current source to regulate the current, and the voltage will take care of itself. It's amazing the counterpoising situation that can be created to create balance in an otherwise out of balance situation, because that's what free energy initially starts out as being. You know, you want more energy out than in, but whoopsie doodle, it happened too fast. Now what do? We just destroyed the circuit. There was one guy on the internet who all he knew how to do in creating his version of an overunity circuit, he would set it up, he'd build it, and he'd start it up, and he could time on his watch to the second how long it would take before it fried itself and stopped producing energy because of its self-destructive tendency, because he didn't know how to build it to regulate itself. All he knew how to build it was to blow up, and it took something like 90 seconds or 45 seconds, and it blew up. It was amazing. Amazing. It was very reliable in that respect. I think I've covered just about everything that could possibly be covered in a very broad sense without getting specific about anything or giving any hard knowledge away. But I gave plenty of clues. So I'll let you deal with it, you know? You think it over. It's the culmination of my almost 5 years of serious study. I mean, I've speculated before I seriously studied, but I saw a movie called An Officer and a Gentleman with Lou Gossett Jr., Deborah Winger, and Richard Gere. And when I saw them in a flight simulator simulating a crash landing in water, flipping over, and now he's got to get out of the cockpit and not drown and panic in the process of drowning himself. I thought, hey, I can do that. I can look up electronic simulators on the internet and start getting serious about this study instead of just speculating all the time. It's nice to imagine and speculate and fantasize, but until you start to get a little bit more realistic with the help of a simulator, you're not making any progress. But if you try to build it on the bench, my God, that's the hard way to do things. Really, really is hard because you can't accomplish much per unit time. The simulator work speeds up your learning curve tremendously. And although people like to say, oh, it's poo-poo it, you know, it's not realistic, well, it depends what simulator you use. LT Spice, they give it away for free. What do you expect? Of course it's not going to be realistic. Even though it's predicated on the Berkeley Spice family of simulators, it's not totally accurate. It makes things too simple. If all you want to use an LT Spice for is an AC circuit that has been regulated by the voltage source from the get-go, from the moment you turn on the circuit, then you don't have much to worry about, do you? But if you're dealing with an over-unity circuit that is a little different than that, now you've got problems on your hands that LT Spice is not going to help you solve. So you have to go to something like MicroCap that used to cost $4,500 before the company went out of business. Because at first, when I first started using their trial version, it was $2,500. I thought, nope, can't afford that. And then before they went out of business, they raised the price to $4,500, and then they gave it away for free once they went out of business. So now you get to use it for free. Yeah, I never had to pay a dime, and now I get to use it for free. MicroCap 12, version 12. The last in the series of development of that simulator. And it's pretty good because it's very hard. It's much harder to get something and come out of it than the use of LT Spice. And LT Spice is harder than Paul Falstead simulators. So I started with Paul Falstead simulator. I graduated to LT Spice, and then I went on to MicroCap because I needed the extra challenge because it wasn't good enough. My development was so good that it became boring. There was no challenge anymore. It was just too easy. Well, MicroCap makes it a little difficult, and I think it's the most accurate of the three. Anyway, you get MicroCap from SpectrumSoft.com, not SpectrumSoftware.com. That's something totally unrelated. But Spectrum-Soft.com, I believe, is the MicroCap website. LT Spice, you know where to get that. Everybody knows. It's been around a while. And it's a nice gimmick to sell the digital electronics that Linear Technologies is trying to sell you because it's inventoried inside of LT Spice. But it's probably okay if you're running chips, which have to have a regulated voltage source. You can't have something, you know, destroy the chips. They're very sensitive. So it's not going to help you study a free energy. It's not going to work. It's the wrong purpose behind LT Spice. Yet it's still a Berkeley Spice, just like MicroCap is another member of the family of Berkeley Spice simulators. Yet it's different. And it's more suitable to my purposes because of its distinct differences. And I'm not even using its full capacity. It's amazing how much stuff it's got in there. I minimally use it, really, when it comes right down to it. I probably would benefit if I took the trouble to learn how to use the software, more of the software, but I don't. It's enough for me to just develop circuits and leave it at that, and then try to figure out, okay, how do you build it? Because the circuits that I design now are not explicit. That I designed for the simulator are not explicit the way you're supposed to build it. They simply represent what the build is because, as I said before, certain things are not designed into our simulator software, so the simulator software doesn't cover everything. And when you start hearing what Oliver Heaviside did and what the Amon brothers did, what Nathan Stubblefield did, and some of the things that Tesla did, you start to wonder via William Line, because you're not going to hear it from anywhere else. You start to wonder, whoops, something was overlooked here. And that's magnetism. Oh, Edward Leedskalnin. Sorry, there is another person I have to mention. His perpetual motion holder is called magnetic remnants. And it's a signature that's left inside the magnetizable iron. of energy having been put in there, but is no longer being put in there. And yet the signature is there, and it can be released, and it will release the same amount of energy that was put in there. It's amazing. And the signature stays there forever. There's no resistance. It stays there forever. It's truly uncanny. And this was the way computer core memory was done between the years of 1955 and 1975, was magnetic remnants. It's a fascinating topic, yet Edward Leeds Scotland, you know, turns the whole thing on its head. And now we're not, you know, using it for magnetic memory. We're using it for power retention as a signature. It's stored there inside the iron. It's unbelievable. So this is why iron becomes a very intriguing component in a circuit, something that's been underappreciated and underutilized. So when I incorporate it into my circuit simulation, I have to infer that it's there, and I have to signify the inference by representing it with a current source, because that's where things get really weird. Now, Paul Falstead's simulator was the only one that allows you to change the magnetic coupling between two inductors beyond unity to up to, I think, 2 billion. And that has some very interesting results. It starts to behave, it starts to become obvious that the magnetic coupling between two inductors is now behaving as a current source, which is exactly what the software designates how inductive reactance occurs inside his software, as in the context of a current source, not a voltage source, but an extra current source that's not part of the circuit. You know, it's implied, but it's not explicitly spelled out, either by Paul or anyone else. Yet that's the only way to understand what magnetic coupling means. Now, I'll finish with this one last thing, and then I'll shut up. The Amon brothers did something very weird, and this is what really intrigued me. If you have to replicate the Amon brothers, you have to replicate all the criteria of the few pieces of information that we have about their demonstration in 1921 of an electric car. And this one little clue is the most intriguing. Their power supply had to be within 10 miles of the motor load. Now, can you imagine transferring power over 10 miles? Come on, give me a break. Nobody in today's world would even conceive of such a thing. No, you would think in terms of, oh my God, there must be huge lightning bolts all over the place, so, you know, like Tesla coils fashion. No, because that's not the way Tesla built his coils. He didn't build them to have lightning come out of them. That was just for show. I mean, that'll electrocute you anyway, and that's something Edison would love to do, is electrocute people to tell you how dangerous it is. No, you keep the energy inside, and so the most that might happen is the coil will glow. The coil will glow, and if you touch the coil, you start to glow because you're not being electrocuted anymore with lightning coming out of your nose, which is what happens in an electric chair when you get fried. No, you glow because this is a totally different way to look at the situation. Oh, boy. I've covered a lot, haven't I? I've covered just about everything I can think of that upturns the silly notions we have that free energy violates the laws of physics when physicists should keep their nose to their own affairs. Anyway, I've spoken now for almost an hour, and now I'm going to shut up.